Welcome to the Past is Present podcast. This is the official podcast of Past is Present, a blog from the American Antiquarian Society. Today we're talking with Ezra Greenspan. Ezra is the Edmund J. and Louise W. Kahn Chair in Humanities at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. He is the author of George Palmer Putnam, Representative American Publisher, and William Wells Brown, An African American Life. He is an AAS National Endowment for the Humanities Fellow for the Year, is an AAS member, and was a Distinguished Scholar in Residence at the Society from 2009 to 2010. The work that he is researching here for the year is titled The Lives and Times of Frederick Douglass and His Family, a Composite Biography.
What or who sort of encouraged you to initially get into the work that you do? I'm sure there was a particular, was there someone in particular who sort of encouraged you to do the work?
I wish I could remember, but I think not. I think actually my career is a story of self-invention and self-guidance to a ridiculous degree. I believe that in this generation, I think young people are better trained or more trained, more guided than was the case for someone like me who came out of college in 74 and finished in grad school in 81. That was a particular generation. I was really at the end of the generation of young people coming out with PhDs and an assured direction into and through the profession. And before the real collapse of the job market. But I was doing something that I couldn't name at the time, nor could any of my teachers. There was no field of book history. And I was groping toward it as an American studies student from undergraduate days through the completion of my PhD without knowing quite what it was I was doing. So in that sense, there's more what than who. The what was probably the product of growing up in a middle-class American Jewish household that valued education and subscribed to every publication under the sun. We had the local municipal newspaper, the state newspaper, the Star Ledger, before it thought to advertise itself as such. We had the New York Times, we had the New York Sun, we had whatever my father brought home, sometimes to wrap my grandmother's greasy productions in, but and then synagogue publications, Look, Life, Time, however many sensory publications there might have been.
So how much of your day did you spend reading when you were...
We read a lot.
Yeah.
We read a lot, and we relied on the kindness of public library. We grew up in reading times, and some of it, of course, was personal. I was a thinking person. I'm not sure my parents thought that I was thinking the right thoughts, but reading print suited me, and we were just inundated in that it might itself be a field of serious intellectual inquiry. I had no idea. In fact, I had no idea even after I'd finished my PhD in 1980-81. I was unaware of the work that was being done by the French, unaware of our good American ambassadors, Darnton and Hall, and that first group of pioneers.
Do you remember the moment when you realized like what you were doing was part of a newly established subfield or field?
Right. I wish I could answer that the next day I woke up and realized, but
that doesn't happen that way.
But it actually happened in a very different way. I was by this point living in Israel. Israel had very little connection. You know, Jews are the people of the book, and have gone around for 2,000 years bragging about it. They weren't talking about book history exactly, and that certainly wasn't part of Israeli academia that I knew. I began in Tel Aviv University in 1981. So I was not only wandering, but really a kind of alien presence in an environment that wasn't ready to support the work that I would eventually do. In any case, I wound up writing, it was my second book, a book about Walt Whitman, that in some ways, I think it would be fair to say, was the first book history approach. It was an authorship-centered, print culture-centered approach to Whitman. And I thought of it at the time as possibly a model of what might be done with any author, and perhaps with larger print-based formations. And I remember around 1988, a colleague of mine, an American colleague, trained at Columbia under Sack Van Berkovich, who said to me, you know, what you're talking about is all very interesting, but what do you call it? What discipline does it fall into? And I scratched my head. I couldn't answer her on the spot. And over a period of months, I realized, this is how poorly trained I was, how essential a question that was. And the book found its way into print, and by the time it came out in 1990, I think it was, there was a field of book history, and this book clearly was part of it.
So as you became more aware of other developments and connected with other people, do you think your methodology changed, or your research habits changed, or your writing changed? And now that book history is such a, you know, everyone seems to be doing book history now.
Right, but we'll need to come back to the term book history, which was a mistake from the beginning.
Okay.
And is even a more serious
mistake.
Well,
maybe you can talk about that now.
Well, let me put it in the terms in which it occurred to me most powerfully. In 1996, I believe it was, it might have been the second or the third International Book History Conference, the Society of the History for the History of Authorship, Reading, and Publishing, SHARP. The board of directors was interested in starting a journal. And for various reasons, they turned to the founding president of the organization, the top-notch British historian, Jonathan Rose. And to me, thinking an American, someone who can handle the Western Hemisphere, Jonathan who could handle the Eastern Hemisphere, we'd play King of the Hill together. And once that decision had been made, I remembering asking at the pre-conference, it might have been the next year, by which point the journal was about to come into being, I asked the people assembled what would be their preferred name for the journal. And book history was the term that came up again and again. And I don't remember whether I spoke out at the time, I certainly did to Jonathan, expressed my lack of satisfaction with the term for pretty obvious reasons, even in the late 1990s, book history, or is it really print history or print culture? Certainly we who study the history of printed artifacts are studying not only books, and we know that books actually constitute a relatively small minority of the mass of publications. But even by the late 1990s, it was clear that print culture was being rivaled, was being surrounded by a new form in the history of written communication.
Yeah.
So book history, doubly problematic, and it was. As to the earlier question, I've never been able to walk a straight line. I have enough trouble navigating my way home. And I believe that within my really limited array of abilities.
You're being humble.
I think I'm being honest.
Yeah.
I've found myself, I can't say I tried consciously, but I found myself adapting again and again.
Mm-hmm.
I started, I thought, as a Jewish studies scholar. And then to the canonical figure of Whitman, But I don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
And I don't teach that for the most part
mm-hmm.
anymore. In this stage of my career, I certainly employ all the,
yeah.
the tricks of the trade, the insights, the
yeah.
formulations, but I study something very different,
yeah.
different subject area,
right.
And employ somewhat different methodologies, also somewhat different theoretical conceptualizations.
So if someone said to you, how would you define the field of the history of the book, or how would you define print culture? What do you say, or what do you say to your students when they say, first day, you know, what is print culture?
I think I might come at it in
mm-hmm.
two different ways. One would be to talk about the history of the history.
Okay.
That is in part what a biographer does,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I see myself primarily as,
mm-hmm.
even when I'm writing works that are deeply involved in the history of print. I'm looking for the biographies, whether it's of people
yeah.
or institutions. So the meeting point of history and historiography, and what better subject matter is there for that
yeah.
than the history of printed
yeah.
matter or digital matter? The long answer is the 16-week course.
Okay.
Invite
yeah.
them to take a ride through
yeah.
The history of their culture or...
Mm-hmm.
whatever
yeah.
culture it might be. The shorter version would be more problematic. I'd have to
really
think about that.
Really hard to encapsulate,
yeah.
Yeah,
I'm supposed to know the answer, but it's not so simple.
But when I think about, you know, books today, I go in, you know, working with them every day, I say, oh, God, what, you know, what do books even mean to me anymore? You know, is there some magic that's lost when you look at a book now? You know, you were a young kid, you know, surrounded by reading. You had an opportunity to just sit and read. I mean, there weren't as many distractions. You didn't have, you know, the job. You didn't have the family. You just were able to focus on what you had in front of you and make connections between, you know, all of your reading.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you look at a book or a newspaper or a periodical in a different way? Has some magic been lost now that you've made it your career?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are two different considerations.
Mm-hmm.
One is the life cycle that we all go through. And would that we could all go back to childhood
yeah.
when you know, things were, at least for most of us,
yeah.
simpler, purer,
mm-hmm.
Less mediated, as it
mm-hmm.
were, and less overwritten with what will come. Certainly children
yeah.
have powers of absorption really are quite remarkable. The other thing, of course, that's changed is the times.
Yeah.
We live in a very different environment. I do find it more difficult to concentrate for both reasons.
Yeah.
But one comes to AAS
yeah.
to concentrate, to block out the world,
yeah.
To enjoy the riches.
So you've tended to, I mean, you are here for a year, several years ago. You're here for almost a year again, 2016
yes.
to 2017, and you've looked at a lot of newspapers over the years. What do the materials here mean to you?
A gigantic
yeah.
question and a very difficult one.
Yeah.
Different books
mm-hmm.
Draw on different kinds
mm-hmm.
of materials. Question is so far-reaching, maybe it's best answered by way of individual project. The William
sure.
Wells Brown biography, I treat it as a cultural biography
mm-hmm.
of a particular
yeah.
individual. And so I focused all my work here at AAS around Brown as kind of representative figure.
Mm-hmm.
Whether he represented his people or not really wasn't the question,
mm-hmm.
but that somehow Brown could easily or perhaps most powerfully be reached through a deep immersion in the culture of the era. That meant, that opened up
yeah.
AAS to me in a remarkably
yeah.
rich and sustaining way.
Mm-hmm.
I could have stayed, you know, I could have sang and stayed forever,
yeah.
But that meant a very deep immersion in AAS's incomparable collections
yeah.
of newspapers, engravings, cartoons, of course, first editions and subsequent 19th century editions. Brown was the most prolific black writer of the era. That meant tracking down every edition of his work and every copy in every library that was within easy reach. The engraving, the daguerreotypes, the photographs, but not just of Brown, but of the entire African American community. Brown's life spanned South and North, slavery and freedom, and he lived virtually the entire course of the 19th century. That opened up the floodgate. It was a very rich sit and read. It was the preparatory year to writing the book.
So you could have stayed forever.
What I could have.
Yeah, what? How do you know when to stop, start writing? And, I mean, you are so prolific, and you have been so, your writing has been so honored, your work has been so honored. I mean, the Brown Book was nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award, and you have received, you know, amazing reviews. How do you do it? How do you bring everything together? How do you write a book that is so, I mean, and it's such a good book, and you do exactly what you set out to do. How do you do it?
If I knew,
yeah, it's just
the Douglas
the skill.
Would
yeah.
be a lot quicker yeah. and easier yeah. job. I think it was largely a matter of experimentation, of making a lot of guesses, and as one gets into a project, doors start to open, windows start to open, and I think one tries to go through them and find out where. You know, what building they lead into next.
And even when you're writing, I mean, do you start at the beginning? I mean, what is your writing process like? Because the writing is good. I mean, the research is good. The writing is good. Do you just kind of start in the middle someplace and build around?
I start at page one.
You start at page one?
I start at page one, and I continue to the last page.
Okay.
I move continuously and consecutively. That may be something that's dictated to me by the needs of the biography. But again, it probably depends on the project. It's an art, not a science. The Douglas is a very different book, and it may have a very different writing process, since I'm still quite far from beginning to write.
Yeah.
Part of the answer to your question is, I don't write until I feel a book is thoroughly researched at very, very mature preliminary level. There's always going to be considerable additional research. Douglas is a very different kind of project for me at AAS. Rather than scoping the collections and scoping the landscape here, I'm actually doing something very different. I spent a couple of months reading the entire file of the leading newspaper in the county in which Douglas, who was a Bailey, the Baileys had lived in for 110 years before Douglas was born, and in which Bailey ancestors have continued to live in the 180 years since Douglas escaped. I read, our file runs from 1818 to 1876 or 77, and it was a way of reading myself into a kind of acquaintance with the neighborhood, the people, the institution, the issues. And since it's almost entirely a whitewashed job, it left me with the very interesting detective work of trying to look into the absences, to peer behind doors that wouldn't open, the shadows, and to find the lives of Douglas's people. And I think that in concert with that, I started reading 19th and 21st century history of some of the leading figures of his time. And here's an AAS story. That particular newspaper file which came to AAS from the Maryland Historical Society, which has, I believe, the largest collection of Maryland, of early Maryland newspapers, but not quite as large a collection as it once did. That file came from Maryland, and it has no name on the pages, but as I began to read through the crucial years of the Civil War, it became 100% clear to me that the owner was one of the most interesting white men in Talbot County, and someone who was keeping an eye on that Fred Bailey who escaped and become Frederick Douglass, the most famous black man in America. And that helped me very much to get at the history from his comments. I'd read through his archive at the Maryland Historical Society, and his notes, which for the most part he did not publish in a coherent fashion, became the basis of the first serious history of Talbot County and of the current late 20th century history of the county. And yet these histories are completely inadequate because they're written from the same white point of view that Harrison's newspaper file was. So it gave me a terrific introduction to and initiation into the world that Frederick Douglass had grown up in, rejected, escaped from. But what was crucial for my purposes was that this is where the rest of the Douglass, of the Bailey family, remained, would remain, and would have to endure for decades, generations, and in some cases a few centuries.
Just give us a brief summary of what this new book is about.
Right. It's a family biography. It's the family of Frederick Douglass, but here's the conundrum, a conundrum of doing African-American history. Names don't signify in the nice, neat, consistent fashion that one likes. The family, more properly, would be called the Bailey family or the Bailey-Douglas family, and there are other names as we go through time. It's a new biography of Douglass. Douglass features front and center, but it approaches Douglass as a figure of family. And so what I'm trying to do is tell Douglass's story in relation to, in correspondence with, the life stories of many members of his family. This is, in many regards, a very novel approach. Mm-hmm. First of all, with Douglass, we've approached Douglass as the great figure. He is the great figure. He does stand above in very powerful ways. His contemporaries recognize that. Douglass recognized that. But by the 21st century, that great individual figure model seems to me, which I've used in a number of my biographies, seems to me less defensible and less consonant with 21st century ideas of social formation, of the importance of family as a model rather than of individuality as a model for understanding, shall we say, American history and culture. So it begins with the notion that it's a family biography, even if it does feature one particular individual. The second principle of it, it's a kind of justification. Why do it with Douglass? Why not with someone else? And there are many reasons, but one overwhelming reason is that Douglass was profoundly a man of family. Profoundly. He loved his family. He never forgot his family. He had them in mind. Even when he was traveling in Europe, he remembered the days of his youth and the people of his youth. And his attempt to recover the past, to me, is both a marker of who Frederick Douglass was, remained his entire life, and it's a marker of the entire Douglass family to this day. They remember him, they remember his history, his words.
And in a way, I guess, I mean, doing a family history is a way to, I mean, there's been so much work on, you know, disintegration of the African-American family, you know, the breakup of the family in the post-war period. And I mean, theoretically, you're, you know, making the family whole again in your work.
Yes, I'm following the very powerful examples of people like Heather Williams.
Mm-hmm.
Her work is work that I find profoundly moving as a scholar and as a person. So in that sense, it certainly is a revisioning of the so-called African-American family. I don't like the term, but... and then, if I'm counting correctly, on the third level, I think a 21st century biography, a second decade 21st century biography, needs to be sophisticated in the ways of media. And in an age of social media, not that social media pertained in the same way in the 19th century, but after all, whom is it that we're speaking of but the man who operated the most powerful media empire, speaking anachronistically, in the African-American world of the 19th century, whose life was the outcome of the media revolution of his time.
Yeah.
And putting together a few of those thoughts, what I'm trying to do, this is the most experimental part of the book, I want to treat the family biography of the Douglases as a continuing narrative, it continues to our own day, in which members of the family relive, rewrite, reclaim their family history. And they can do so, in some cases, on privileged terrain. They have family lore, and they have a kind of continuity not available to an outside biographer like me. And that's a kind of living stream that, to me, is of the essence of writing a family biography in the second decade of the 21st century. So, you know, in some ways we're coming back to where we started. what is book history? Well, it's media history. What is media history? Media history is something that, like biography, has a live current to it. Mm-hmm. One traces the current and one understands that the current moves backward and forwards. And what I'm hoping is that the book will, in the end, find means of making Douglas's life and the lives of the continuing lives of his family, those people who preceded him and those who followed him, continuous in ways that will speak backwards and forwards and right and left to one another. Douglas, in one of his most powerful orations, talked about our composite nationality. It's a test term that I'm using at the early stage, but the subtitle right now is a composite biography.
Thank you, Ezra, and thank you to everyone for listening. You can find more information about and download this podcast at pastispresent.org. You can also download the podcast or subscribe at iTunes. I'm Ashley Cataldo. Our theme song is History Explains Itself by Josh Spacek. And stay tuned for more episodes from Past is Present.